Okay, we're going to start now. I'm Roger Watson. I'm the Vice President of the NCUP. We are recording this lecture. I will record the lecture up until the end of the actual talk, and then I'll turn it off for about 10 to 15 minutes of questions and answer. And I'm now going to hand over to our President, Janet Wilson, to introduce Sir Anthony Selden. Thanks, Janet.
Thank you very much, Roger, and greetings, everybody. It's wonderful to see such a large number of you as the president of NCUP, and having been so for a very, very difficult year, it's quite a triumph to have an occasion like this where we actually see some of our constituency and some of their friends and the general public. I just hope that you will enjoy this lecture and we'll be considering perhaps joining NCUP. We've widened our conditions of entry, and you'd be very welcome to contact our executive officer, Cheryl Humphrey, who sent out the invitations, if you're interested in joining after it's over. As Roger has said, Sir Anthony will talk for about 40 minutes, and there'll be some time for questions at the end. So, it's my huge pleasure and privilege to introduce Sir Anthony Selden, previously the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Buckingham and one of Britain's leading contemporary historians, educationalists, commentators and political biographers. He's the author or editor of over 45 books on contemporary history, including insider stories of the last five prime ministers. He is chair of the National Archives Trust, was the co-founder and first director of the Institute for Contemporary British History, is co-founder of the Action for Happiness, an historical advisor to 10 Downing Street, a member of the government's first World War Culture Committee, and he was chair of the Comment Awards, director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, the president of IPEN, which is the International Positive Education Network, a co-founder of the Institute for the Ethics of AI and Education, and is patron or on the board of many charities. Founder of the Via Sacra Western Front Walk, and was executive producer of the film Journey's End. So truly a man of many parts. He was a transformative head for 20 years, first of Brighton College and then Wellington College. He appeared on Desert Island Discs in 2016, and for the last 15 years has given all his money from writing and lecturing to charity. We're hugely honoured to have him address us today, and his talk is titled A New Vision for HE Post-COVID. Sir Anthony.
As I said, I'm very honoured to be asked to give the NCUP annual lecture. Thank you very much indeed for this honour, and what a moment to be reflecting on higher education. And I'm going to be arguing that this is a moment for real change. When we have change in society, it often is prompted by or accelerated by underlying forces, or accelerated by a very dramatic event. It could be a huge economic downturn, such as in the early 1930s, or indeed 2008-09 saw some significant changes after the great global financial crisis. War, we know, is an enormous accelerant of change, but so is an epidemic on this scale. And I am going to be arguing that this is the moment for HE to move from, and this is the gist of the whole argument, from being a policy taker, and by that word policy I mean policy for what the objectives of HE is, how it's to be funded, how it's to be delivered, what the content is, to move from being a predominantly decision taker with decisions taken elsewhere, to a decision maker, and that COVID provides the impetus for what many people, including myself, over 5 years as a vice Vice-Chancellor felt, and I was puzzled, that universities were not punching their weight. And that the lead is not going to come from government. Government is not designed, equipped, to know what to do with higher education. In as far as it has a view, it's a very transactional view about higher education for jobs for the economy, and or higher education to train the doctors and nurses that we need. It doesn't have an educational vision, or a pure research vision for what it needs and wants higher education to be. And into that space, indeed into that vacuum, HE has to step. And HE has to step because nobody else is going to provide that lead. Until the early 1960s, the Robbins Report of 1963, and then the arrival that October 1964 of the Harold Wilson government, committed to a white heat and a scientific revolution with a new image, a new vision for universities, government started to become far more involved in the determination of what university policy should be. And I'm saying that we need to go back to that pre-early 1960s era and become our own decision makers. And that is not the least because there are, as you'll hear, an unparalleled 24, I left some out, problems, 24 different problems, which I will talk about, afflicting the HE sector. And we need to act as never before in reaching a collective voice. Now, there are a lot of reasons we don't have a collective voice. There is little uniting on the face of it. Highlands and Islands University to the University of Oxford. There is the Russell Group, which, for very understandable reasons, is interested in the interests of the Russell Group. Universities have been encouraged, and not for wholly bad reasons at all, to compete more against each other. What we've lost is that sense of a collective mission, collective vision, collective capacity to articulate the overall vision of what higher education is, in which this country has led the world for so many, many years. And we need to rediscover that collectivity. Now, there is a collective body, Universities UK, for which I have the highest admiration. And that body, which it has an outstanding president, an outstanding chief executive, Alistair Jarvis, the president obviously rotates and does extraordinary work, but it is not equipped to take the kind of leading role that I think that it needs to be taking. And my experience of 25 years of writing about and talking intently to figures in side number 10 Downing Street is that they would respect HE much more if it was to be far prouder, far stronger, dare I say, an element of fear when it engages with the higher education sector rather than a slight doff your cap. It's so nice that you've come and addressed our annual conference, Minister. So nice that you're consenting to agree to talk to us. If there was just number 10 takes people seriously if they take themselves seriously. And I think there could be more attitude and more force and more direction. And that would help. I think that UUK does need to have a full-time president. This is no criticism of the rotating president model. It isn't the individuals, it's the model. If you're only there for 2 years, and if you are also running your own university, whether give the time that you need to give to running a peak organization. So I think the CBI could be one model, for example, that could be learned about having that full-time chief executive. I would favor somebody who had been a much respected vice chancellor for a long time, knows all the people, knows all the issues, knows all the people in Whitehall, in Westminster, in journalism, in the whole, knows people throughout the unions, throughout all the clients and stakeholder groups. An excellent person would be, I'm not advocating him, but just to give you an example, the kind of person I have in mind, it would be either Crew, who I understand has turned down from the position of chairman of the chair of the Office for Students, either Crew, who had been vice chancellor amongst many things at the University of Essex, as well as master, I think that's what it is still called, at University College Oxford. That kind of person with that kind of clout and that kind of knowledge, that kind of contacts and freedom, and 5 years to really carry it. I think that the UK could learn more from bodies like HEPI, Higher Education Policy Institute, run by the brilliant Nick Hillman, which with a very small staff really makes the weather week after week. I think it could learn a lot from bodies like ASCL, ASCL, Association of School and College Leaders, with its head, Jeff Barton, who is forever all over the press. They can learn from bodies like the Resolution Foundation and the PR and marketing department there, which is again constantly leading the headlines. And I think that if we do this, we will be newsmakers rather than news takers. We'll be policy makers, not policy takers, agenda setters, not agenda takers. And I think that the crisis of COVID will provide that very moment, that world war moment, or that huge economic crisis moment, to reset the dial, which is what I'm arguing in this talk. So I think I will now come through the slides, having set out my stall. And you know, HE is under attack from government. It is under attack from the OFS. By under attack, I mean it's constantly having new expectations posed of it, new requirements, and from the public, reflected by the media. The public has fallen out of love with universities. It is pointless railing against the Mail or the Sunday Times or the Express or whatever newspaper it is, the Times, the Telegraph. They are reflecting what their readers are saying, as are their commentators. And rather than being behind the curve, sector needs, I think, to be ahead of it. Despite, you know, the sector's under attack, a sector which I absolutely love and was immensely proud of to be a vice chancellor for 5 years, despite the fantastic COVID contribution, the production of vaccines, the epidemiologists, mathematicians, modellers, economists, supplying of doctors and nurses, despite all that, despite the economic impact, the worst recession for 300 years, and the fact that universities are going to be needed to be at the heart of that, despite the political, social, and economic regeneration needed post-Brexit, you would expect universities to be right at the very top. I don't think the government has a clear policy for HE in the same way that it has for further education. And insofar as it has, it's a very transactional vision. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just education is more than tests and exams and providing people for the economy. And by the way, I think that we could be doing a much better job there. It has no clear policy, I'm saying, for HE on new and independent providers. Now, I feel that quite strongly, having run the University of Buckingham, Britain's first independent university. It was very hard with our medical school, with our own activities, to find that space and opportunity to allow us to flourish. We did flourish, but it was despite government not because of government, funding the sector. I mean, it has all kinds of ideas, but it's far from clear the role of OFS, what exactly it wants from that with its new chair, teaching and learning, regulations, so many, but that vision for education is the main point. The vision for pure research, the vision for what it means to be an educated undergraduate, educated postgraduate. We have to supply that. The sector has to supply that. So looking at HE in 2021, HE should be, I would think, proud and very self-confident. Certainly deserved to be. I mean, HE has done a really good job, despite the headlines about the some students. I think HE has done something in providing a quality of education for undergraduates and postgraduates, which within the resources it has available to it, I think has done a very good job, but it's not the job that we hear. It should be celebrated, I think, by government, by OFS far more, and it should be critical and undefensive and taking its future into its own hands, shaping its own future, not letting others who don't have that pure interest of higher education in heart and who never will understand higher education as well as the practitioners. But it feels under attack and demoralised. It suffers from an incoherent and unstrategic government policy and a very, a very transactional government policy. So, and it should be core theme of the policy. It is a policy taker, it needs to be a policy maker. So let me now move on to the next section, which is to look at the challenges. I'm sure, like you, if you're at a wedding and you have a best man speech another speech, an afternoon speech, somebody says, you know, I'm going to go through the A to Z, and you think, oh my goodness, please, no. But I was struck by these 24 challenges that come up, and that the sector, I think it has to be true that the sector has never, the leadership of the sector, those who make it up, all the various stakeholders have never had more to contend with. And A stands for affordability. And who is going to pick up the tab? Affordability is an extraordinary issue. So is the whole issue of BAME access, fair access. By the way, there's a scraping. There could be a comment around scraping the barrel here, but could the scraper perhaps turn off? Could the scraper mute their? If everyone can mute their switches. A lot of work, a lot of reports have come out to show that. Not just is it harder to get in to Oxford and Cambridge, which have been working extremely hard, and other of the most academic universities, which have also been working hard. It's very hard to get in, nevertheless, if you do come from a BAME background. And then once you're there, your experience often is not as good and as positive as it can be. Which the universities are having to spend a lot of time rightly considering and thinking about. And then China. I remember a discussion 18 months ago with a group of vice chancellors over lunch and with a representative from UUK. And we discussed what the greatest single threat was, and it was the dependency of universities on Chinese students. At the time, the figure mentioned was 106,000, and you can all work out what a huge impact that is if lost. So the China dependency and the terms of trade have shifted away from China, whereas under the Blair government and then Brown and then very much under David Cameron and George Osborne, a very strongly pro-Chinese tilt to government policy with premiers visiting Chequers under both Brown and premiers or presidents visiting under both Gordon Brown as Prime Minister and David Cameron, and a sense that everything was up for grabs with China. Now partly very, very significantly inspired by China's own actions, China has become much more of a hostile force, and yet the dependency on undergraduates and postgraduates and finance, in the last week we've seen a lot of suspicion about what Chinese money and Chinese influence is doing. So that's another headache. The ability to change away from China and to find alternative sources of students and revenue, if the drawbridge is pulled up, that will take a lot of time to do. D is for digital. Every single aspect of life at the university is being questioned by digital, by COVID, even before AI. And the fourth education revolution with mixed reality, augmented reality, virtual reality, blockchain, Internet of Things, that whole cluster of AI technologies, which will sweep away exams and change forever the nature of testing and assessment and experiments. That is perhaps the biggest challenge. Very interesting article in the Observer over the weekend, looking at whether the university sector is doing nearly enough to embrace all of that. And that's a particular theme of my own writing, the fourth education revolution. And then E, the environment. And it's going to COP26 coming up at the end of this year. It's going to cost a lot of money, quite rightly, obviously, very rightly, but to make our universities far greener. And where is that money going to come from? And the urgency of that with COP26, the urgency of that with all the reports coming about why this is a bigger threat all the time, is yet another headache for a sector that already has enough headaches. And F is further education. There is Hartlepool College of further education enrolling now, and the very obvious thing by government, the government is very much in favour of further education. What will that do to the sector? And then more generally, government policy and who's in charge of it? And is it the university's minister, Michel Donnellan? Is it the education secretary with a rapid turnover of education secretaries, the rapid turnover, 5 in 5 years, was it 6 in 5 years of university's ministers? Or is it number 10, which has its own very clear view about HE, and even when it's put together, it's a transactional view of higher education, which is not necessarily our view, and there you are, you don't even need me to say that, how this, so COVID, the enormous disruptions we come up to towards the first anniversary, the enormous disruption of COVID, which is going to carry on, and there'll be variants, and will there be new epidemics in the future, and what is that going to be saying? Janet mentioned that I'm a governor at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and just think there what that means if you are a theatre company with different theatres in in Stratford and London, and what is going to be the future of live performance? And will it ever be the same? Should we be converting to moving all digitally, all outdoor performance? If so, will the economics finances work out so that you can have enough spacing between bubble groups to allow there to be enough revenue to make the performance possible? I mean, the headache of all of this is extraordinary. I international students, and there you have Monash. That has to be one of the ugliest university buildings I have seen. I don't quite know why that one has come up, but Monash, biggest university in Australia, enormous threat. We're very, very fortunate, the sector, to have the former Vice Chancellor of the University of Exeter now is the international champion, a phenomenal Vice Chancellor and university leader who is going to be doing everything he can to ensure that international students, who are so important in every way, far beyond just finance, continue to flow. But the competition is going to increase. And Jay, journalists from across the spectrum, and I do think that the commentariat has substantially been lost. You could say, well, look, the Mail and the Mail on Sunday, the Express, the Telegraph, the pro-Brexit universities, even before Brexit, was a twinkle in the eyes of Bill Cash and Nigel Farage and others, that even before then they were sceptical about universities. But it's not just them, it's the middle ground of commentators in the Sunday Times and the Times who have fallen out of love with universities, and the unwillingness, as a brilliant paper by Rosie Bennett, who is the former education correspondent of the Times, which HEPI are publishing, I believe, tomorrow, Thursday, looking at this question. More could and should have been done, not to trash as too many voices in HE and HE outlets do the press, but to engage with what is it that is upsetting and concerning them. The middle ground of journalism needs to be got back on side, and they are reflecting what the public thinks. The media sometimes go out on the line, but by and large they are in a desperate battle against the digital outlets for readers, and they will be saying what their readers want to hear. Key leaders' salaries, and it is the Vice Chancellor of Bath did a terrific job at Bath. It was unfortunate that that issue, and again, the sector, rather than providing a coherent voice and taking action into its own hands, and maybe instituting a 20% cut, or at least acknowledging 10% cut, 5% cut, acknowledging that there was an issue, did not respond, and was in denial about the damage done to the perception of the sector by that leadership. And of course, if you were a Vice Chancellor Court there, you were just fixed in the spotlights. I think that significantly it was the boards of governors that should have not let salaries rise too high. L, liquidity, which is a growing problem for some universities, particularly universities in the levelling up areas, left behind areas, those areas, those universities that are making a cultural, economic, social impact of such a force for good in their communities are the ones which are suffering and which cannot be afforded to lose. Mental health of students, and let us not forget staff and all kinds of support staff in every position, as well as academics and technicians and research staff and others. It is an area where a very great worry. When I first raised this 5 years ago, obviously lots of other people raised it too, but I was slapped down strongly and told that, what did I know, but also that universities are not therapeutic institutions. And there's been, again, it's been too little, I think, often the wrong kinds of things are too late. The sector could have got right ahead. The response from the sector on mental health is just, well, let's have more therapists, more counsellors. And that, of course, is important. More psychiatrists, more help. Of course you need that, but you also need to be providing and linking up with schools more the growth in capacity of the student. It's akin to helping people once they've fallen off the edge of the waterfall, or when they've already developed COVID, and offering them superlative help at that stage. We should be doing much more to prevent people by vaccinating them, by giving them the skills to cope much better, including much better policies on alcohol and drugs, which are a contributory factor amongst many to the mental health crisis. N is, you know, the whole question of, you know, is there a need, especially for residential universities? Are we needed any more, or can that person under the tree with her unbranded cup of coffee and her laptop be getting all the lectures that she needs, taking part in all the seminars, having the tutorials, doing her research for her assignments, be doing her, submitting her assignments, getting the feedback, doing her exams? Do we need to have universities at all, or indeed residential universities? And there we have the office for students, the government, in their wisdom, have appointed somebody who admits themselves they don't have a background in higher education when there were other candidates who did. And when it says no friend, there's a deliberate intention not to be a friend, you know, to be a regulator. And yet, why is the sector not regulating itself more? Why is it putting itself in that vulnerable position? Pensions, well, is a constant and ongoing concern and worry for universities. Q, goodness, I'm feeling the exhaustion from you listening to this, but imagine what it's like if you're running a university, whole debate about qualifications, post-qualification entry, the whole reliability, the whole fairness of exams. During COVID, the 2020 intake, the 2021 intake, somebody on the Today programme, yesterday, was it today, a student qualifying this year, saying he feels that it's going to be a COVID degree and that degree isn't going to be recognised by employers, are all these worries. And then the whole exam factory mentality that this government and all governments globally are obsessed with, that exams are testing anything other than the ability to do well at exams. By the way, that will all change totally in 10 years' time. And then what's this going to be about the relevance of the arts and the humanities on the slide? You will have seen the reports 10 days ago about are the decline in these? Are universities merely going to be job, skill agencies that pump the knowledge that you need in, or are we going to have pure education and pure research? Speech and a free speech, no platforming, a free speech czar, and no platform for fascism. But is it fascism to deny people the right to speak within the law, obviously, if they're not going to be breaking the law or inciting hatred? Don't universities survive by their ability to ask awkward and difficult and challenging questions, and not having a dominant monoculture where people are afraid to say and think and speak things outside? That whole question is extraordinarily difficult for university leadership to negotiate. Teaching and what the quality of teaching is, and why, again, universities didn't take into their own hands more the question about what outstanding teaching is about, and but focused less on teaching, frankly, which it should have been on learning, as I'm sure those listening to this will know, that that it's about learning. It's not actually about teaching. A good teacher is merely a great facilitator of learning. It's what the students are thinking about. And to have had a self-improving system whereby departments within universities, faculties, pioneered their own exciting method with student feedback was something, you know, yet again. And there's a lot to commend the Pearce review on teaching, but that's all TEF, yet another. And then there's TEF, knowledge education framework, and there's REF, and on it goes. And there's unions which do so much that's good, but which also are a thorn in the side of university leadership at times. That's right, necessary, obviously, that should be that different perspective, different voice, but it's a challenge, and not least a challenge for Manchester at the moment, where students are trying to pass a vote of no confidence in the leadership of the university, and to be a vice chancellor is an uncomfortable process, place to be. And then the unity of the sector, have we lost sight of that? That is the Highlands and Islands at the bottom. That is Oxford at the top, as I posed at the beginning. Have we lost sight of what conjoins us? Value for money, are students getting it? Should they be recompensed? I think, yes, they should. They should receive some recompense for the last year. This is a much bigger issue just than value for money during the COVID year, which is obviously going to stretch on now till autumn of 2021, and maybe, I'm afraid, beyond that. But just looking at COVID, should students, I think definitely, but I don't think universities should be providing the money. I think that the government should be providing some recompense and acknowledgement to students. W, which is the last, the whole sense about what it is that universities are supposed to be teaching, and the buildings and decolonisation. And here is a picture, well, you can see. So all these are very significant worries. Any one of those 24 are significant in themselves, but cumulatively, and there are some out of kindness to you that I've left out, cumulatively it packs a heavy punch. So how might we respond, just coming to a close? And Janet and Roger, I can't see you, but I'm sure you're thinking, when is he going to close down? Any moment is the answer. Don't wait for government or the OFS, who are, you know, full of good people. Sorry to say that if that upsets people, but they're people doing their best within their remits. But their remit isn't the same remit as what HE necessarily has itself, a unified voice. I think it could be leading on finance much more, leading on AI and edtech, leading on teaching and learning, leading on a common core of what it means, whether you're studying engineering or whether you're studying the history of art or sports science or tourism, to have a common core of digital literacy. Joseph Aoun of Northeastern University in Massachusetts talks a lot about this, social literacy, employment literacy. So that Mary Clannad Cook, former head of UCAS, is talks a great deal of sense and has set up an interesting, important body looking to one of the aspects is trying to advance this. I mean, we should not just be letting somebody have an engineering or a tourism degree. They need to have this common core element that it does include well-being, as I put there, and I'd like to see us lead in the other areas too. Universities, to conclude, need to become the policy makers, not the policy takers. And then I say it's the end of the talk, but not of universities. So there